So, what I would like to do here now is something that none of us expected. I have a statement from Judy Berry that I'm going to read, and I'd like everybody just to take a deep breath, and we'll all sit tight and go through this together. And then we're going to end up the rest of the show with some nice, mellow music. Okay. To my friends and neighbors, the reason that I'm not doing my radio show today is because I have recently learned that I have breast cancer. Worse still, it has metastasized to my liver, and the prospects are not good. I don't know the reason for this, whether it is the hormone-latent foods I was brought up on, or the estrogen-mimic poisons with which LP and Caltrans are blithely drenching our county, or none of the above. I do know that 40 years ago, one out of 20 women got breast cancer. Today the rate is 1 out of 8, and in the Bay Area it is 1 out of 7. I will, of course, fight this as best I can. I appreciate the prayers, love, and good wishes that I know you are sending my way. I hope you will appreciate that at this time, I need my privacy and the company of my intimate, immediate family. So please don't call me for a while. I will reemerge as soon as I can. If you want, you can write me at P.O. Box 656, Willits, California, 95490. As you can tell, it's an emotional statement for me to read. This is something that was just discovered in the last few days. I was only made aware of it yesterday. I know that the news has gone up to base camp. I believe they were going to put it out in the circle today. Judy has asked that she has some space to deal with this, and then she will come back and talk to her listeners and to all of us. It's been very upsetting around here. It's been very upsetting for all of us, I know. This is a very difficult issue for all of us to deal with. But she's a fighter. She's a damn hard fighter. And I think we can all help her by sending her our prayers and our love. I know in these situations I get a nice white candle, put her name on it, and I will burn that nice white candle with all my love and energy going her way. And I think it would be great to give her some time, and she'll be back on the air, and we'll all go forward. She's not a lone tree in this forest anymore. There's a lot of us out here, and we're all here to help as much as we can. So we'll go forth, and what I'd like to do is we're just going to take some nice quiet time here and play some music, because I know, as I know many of our listeners, need to just take some time and digest this, and then we'll go forth and be strong and fight like heck. And thank you for listening to Punch and Judy, and we'll keep our thoughts with her, Judy.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
Okay, welcome to the Punch and Judy Show. This is your host, Judy Berry. Well, last week, of course, I didn't show up at my show, and I dropped the devastating news on you all, at least devastating to me, that I've learned that I have cancer. And I asked people not to call me because I was overwhelmed, and I certainly was. I guess I still am. And I appreciate the people who didn't call. And I appreciate the people who wrote me letters and all the sentiments that people have been sending my way. I felt humiliated by the sensationalism, especially. I felt like I needed to tell you all who listen to this show. I needed to tell my own community. I needed to tell the people who listen to KMUD. But when the Press Democrat picked it up and put it on the front page on a banner headline so that it would show in the newsstand so they could sell more newspapers, I found that really humiliating, and it made it a lot harder for me to get out in the public and talk to people and stuff like that. But, you know, I've had enough pathos in my life, and I've had enough people feeling sorry for me, and, you know, I definitely don't feel normal. There's no question about that. I'm very tired. I don't have the energy that I usually have, and more things hurt than usually hurt. But, you know, I'm still able to function. So what I think I want to do is to keep functioning as much as I can and as long as I can. And I've dropped out of a lot of the things that I normally do. I've dropped out of the Headwaters organizing. It wasn't an easy thing to do, but, you know, the trees wouldn't let me go last summer, but this fall the trees let me go. And they let Alicia go, too, because both of us, I don't know, I guess we've done our job, whatever. But Alicia's living with me, of course. She's my roommate, and she's doing a great job of taking care of me and my family as much as we need to be taken care of. But, you know, I'm just going to keep going as best as I can. And this isn't actually even, of course, it's very devastating to get this kind of news. And I kind of got it in pieces last week. At the beginning of the week on Monday, I learned that, yes, it was definitely breast cancer, but it seemed that it was kind of mild and it would be able to be dealt with, you know, with a lumpectomy and radiation, something not too intrusive that wouldn't put me out for too long, that would give me some indefinite survival rate afterwards. And I had just kind of, you know, reacted to the relief of finding out that it wasn't that serious when I found out on Wednesday that it had metastasized to my liver and is actually very aggressive and a very difficult to treat kind of cancer. So they canceled the lumpectomy because it wasn't going to do any good anymore. And I'm trying to find ways to deal with it. But as hard as it is for me to deal with it, and it is definitely hard, I'm not trying to minimize it. It's probably less hard for me than it is for a lot of other people because I've already dealt with death. I dealt with that in 1990. And I think I've made my peace with it. I don't have any death wishes, that's for sure. And I certainly want to raise my children. And I certainly want to stay in this world and keep interacting in this world. But, you know, this isn't even the worst thing that's ever happened to me. If the FBI pulled up and arrested me for having cancer, then it might be the worst thing that's ever happened to me. So I guess I've been through enough hell that a little more is not going to keep me completely out of the picture. And what I want to do is just keep working on things and keep being in the world and keep dealing with issues as they come up and not just dwell on this. Now, I gave some statistics last week, and I want to repeat them. I hear that it's gotten around the Bay Area and various news and stuff that I'm claiming that I got cancer from Garlon, and I'm not claiming that. I think that it usually sits in your body for a long time, and I don't think I've been exposed to Garlon for that many years. But what I did say was that I mentioned the estrogen-mimic poisons that LP and Caltrans are blithely drenching our county with. And what I said, and this statistic, I'm pretty sure this is a true statistic. I got it from the Terrain magazine from Berkeley Ecology Center, and then this issue was also covered in the San Francisco Chronicle a couple weeks ago. And that is that 40 years ago, 1 in 20 women got breast cancer, and today that rate is 1 in 8. And in the Bay Area, it's 1 in 7. And actually, I don't think Mendocino counts as the Bay Area, so to be perfectly honest about this, so we're only dealing with 1 in 8. And I know I never knew anybody that had cancer, and I'm sure everybody that's listening to this show knows lots and lots of people who do. So I think the question of whether or not there are environmental causes as to whether this world is just becoming too toxic to live in is certainly something that we need to think about. But as far as what I'm going to do, I'm not going to spend this whole show talking about this. If you want to call in, I'll let you call in for a little while, but not too much, because there's other stuff happening, and I want to focus on it. For one thing, because this show is a public affairs show. It's not a private affairs show. It's not an affair show about me. It's a show in which I'm the host to bring other affairs to you. So I have other things planned for this show that we're going to talk about, but I will give people a couple minutes if they want to be able to make some comments. But the one thing I want to say is I really appreciate all the people who have offered their various remedies and stuff like that. And unfortunately, ultimately, this is not curable. I mean, it can be delayed, but as far as I can see, it's not curable. But what I need to say about it is that the choices, the whatever choices, healing choices that I make are personal choices. And although I appreciate the information and I want to be educated, I want to know all of the possible choices, what I choose is what I choose. And I can't do everything at once, and I don't want people to be insulted as I've been inundated with various, you know, remedies and cures and stuff like that. And I really understand that people are coming from a position of wanting to help, but it's very overwhelming from my point of view. And so I just would like to ask you to just trust me that I'm going to do everything that I can without, I mean, I've already ruled out chemotherapy. I'm not going to, like, let them drip some drug into my veins called slow death a toxin or something like that. That's going to, like, what they said is it'd give me a survival rate of another year if I spend 6 months doing these very intrusive poisons. So I'm not going to do that, but I'm willing to do other things, both straight medicine and alternative medicine, and I'm trying to. So please just trust me and rest assured. And I'm going to take this call, but I really don't want to spend this whole show dwelling on this. Okay, caller on the air. Hello?
Yes, hello, Ms. Barry.
Yes.
You had just mentioned that your show was a public affairs rather than a private affairs show. I would like to just posit that your recent discovery and, shall we say, illness... is actually, and as you have led your life, is a metaphor for a lot of larger things, and that hence your private affair with this unfortunate news is actually, could easily be seen as something far bigger and not necessarily without without merit as a complete public interest matter.
Well, actually, I mean, I think obviously that has some merit. That's why I announced it in the first place. But
right,
I just
right.
don't want to dwell on it.
And you know, I'm the guy that wrote you the letter presciently enough, and I didn't mean to be rude, and I certainly had no knowledge of your personal situation about perhaps people with rather costly to treat diseases chaining themselves to trees. And running up unbearably high medical bills on the county.
Well, actually, I did read the letter, and I'm going to take the next caller and answer you on the air.
Thank you. I would appreciate that. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Okay. So, next caller, hold on for 1 second while I answer that. This was a letter suggesting that people with very dire diseases chain themselves to trees, get arrested, et cetera, and therefore the county would have to handle the medical bills. First of all, I want to say that people with dire diseases are not in physical condition to chain themselves to trees. And, you know, I'm in a fairly early stage here, and I don't feel like chaining myself to any tree or being shoved around in jail. So that's the first point. But then the second point is all you get arrested for is some little misdemeanor. I mean, you can be cited and released. They're not going to have to cover your medical costs unless you're sentenced to years and years in prison. Just a little transient stay in prison doesn't require them to pick up the medical costs. So it was a creative thought, I guess I could say, but I don't think that it would actually work. So thanks for the suggestion. If anybody else wants to do it, they're welcome to, but I'm not planning on chaining myself to any trees. Okay, so next caller, you're on the air.
Judy?
Yeah.
Hi. First of all, you're being fabulously brave, and I admire and respect you as always. My thought is that while the movement is really devastated by your illness, the young people up north in the headwaters are just rallying, doing what they need to do to carry on, and that you've been able to relieve yourself of this burden is really good, and it's going to, you know, go on strong and hopefully prevail. And, you know, as discouraging as your illness is, there's a lot of room for optimism in what's happening up at the headwaters, and I want to thank you for the years you put into this.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay?
Okay.
Bye then.
All right. Yeah, that's really true. I mean, I felt if I would have dropped out last summer, I think it might have made a lot of difference. But now that things are really rolling, it's very inspiring. Everybody who's been up to base camp can tell you this, how self-organized people are and how dedicated they are. The fact that they're even still there is pretty stunning. And there's actually going to be something coming up. I was going to have Naomi call in later and tell us about it, but now might be the time, Naomi, if you want to call in. I know there's events being planned for November 15th, which we certainly hope is the end of the logging season. It's supposed to be the end of the logging season anyway. The problem is because what they're doing is salvage logging in some cases, we don't know if it's subject to the end of the logging season or not. I'll take this other call. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Judy. This is Naomi.
Oh, that was quick.
I got my cue.
All right.
It is timely, and I want to let everyone know that we are announcing a rally and demonstration that you are all invited to on November 15th at noon at the Fisher Gate near Carlotta, the same place that many of you got arrested before, or those of you who didn't might have another opportunity. If you wanted to express yourselves that way, there's a group that may swim across the line of salmon, so you might want to let your imaginations roam.
That sounds fun.
But it's a legal public demonstration being called to protest the ongoing salvage logging and clear cutting in the 60,000-acre area that we're trying to save. And to, you know, the nature of salvage logging is that it's ongoing. So this is not any kind of grand finale or anything. It's a way of reaffirming our commitment to save headwaters.
So, Naomi, do we actually know now that that they're not going to stop on November 15th? Do they stop when the soil gets saturated? Do they ever stop?
Well, as near as we can tell, since salvage logging is by definition an exemption type of logging, they don't have to apply for a permit to do winter operations. So the winter operations thing is just not, it's not a factor in this. Really, soil saturation is the factor that they consider, and then there's other things in terms of sediment and so on. But basically, when it gets too wet to get your equipment out, I guess they have to stop for a while. And then if the soil dries out enough, they can go back in. So it is an ongoing thing that Hurwitz can just keep right on taking out profits and dealing at the same time.
Wow, they're really disgusting, but we already knew that.
Right. So it's great to hear your voice, and we'll be letting people know more details about this. If you'd like to get information right away, call the MEC at 468-1660 or my number at 459-0548. But I will be out of town off and on, so it's best for you to contact the MEC and leave your name and number, and I'll contact you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Judy.
Okay. All right, we got another caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, Judy. As Ralph Nader likes to say, or I've heard him say, the leader's job is to train other leaders. You've been doing a terrific job as a true leader, you know, in training other people. The self-sufficiency up there in the Headwaters organization this year is terrific proof of that. And you should know that whatever the outcome of your current crisis, I guess, that that's going to go on for a long time.
And, yeah, I think so, too. And I appreciate the compliment, and I certainly don't deserve all the credit. There are a lot of people besides me who have been doing this. But I think our whole movement has really, I don't know if I want to use the word maturity. It's kind of very,
I think it's an appropriate word. I think that's a real appropriate word. And people who have known me have heard me say that in Sacramento and Washington that there's a real lack of maturity there, and any place maturity can come from is great, and hopefully whatever things come up in the future, 10, 20, 30 years from now, that maybe some of those young people up there will find their way into that and bring that maturity forth, and in no small way, perhaps, you have brought that forward.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Okay, we got another caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Judy, it's Naomi. I've got to add one more.
Naomi, you always call twice.
Sorry, I forgot this. But on the subject of maturity, and the caller before that mentioned that the young people in base camp, and I want to say it's the young people, the middle people, and the old people. There is such diversity of age. And I won't say multi-gender, but you can really find your niche there.
All right.
Come to base camp before the 15th if you possibly can in your own action group.
Okay, great.
Bye.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, that is a really good point. There are a lot of older people, particularly older women, who are just totally, you know, carrying stuff. It's amazing to me when I see the range of ages of the people that are working. And so that is a good point, because the young people, you know, can hike farther sometimes, but I have never met anybody who can hike any farther than Naomi. So, yeah, let's not write them all off as young people. So anyway, what I'm going to do now, I'm going to move on to some other subjects. And the first thing I'm going to be doing is I'm going to put on some music for a minute, and I'm going to be calling Karen Pickett. And what we're going to be talking about is, you may have read in the newspapers that Earth First loses slap suit, and I don't know, we'll talk about the way they described it when I get her on the air. And this was the slap suit that happened in Idaho. Karen, of course, was one of the people that was sued. So I'm going to put on some music. What I'm going to put on is Joanne Rand singing Koyana Skatsi, which just seems appropriate to me for how out of balance this whole world. That is a Hopi word for life out of balance, is Koyana Skatsi. So I'm going to put on this music, and I'll call Karen, and then I'll come back, and we'll go on with that. Thank you.
to lead a clean moral life. The alarm beeped at 6 and I worked till 5. I got my paycheck every other week. Sadie told her mama didn't gamble a drink, so she could buy a color TV, electric curling iron, and new false teeth. Drive the girls to the video arcade and buy my few games on me. Coy on a Scott, it's a crazy world. I hope you got a word for the way that we're doing it. Crazy world. Hope you got a word for the way that we're going it. Coy on a Scotsy. Crazy world. I hope you got a word for the way that we're dying. Well, a philosopher said in a book I read, our style of living will soon be dead. Needle outweigh the supply, they say, in 1993. Coy on a Scotsy, crazy world. Hope you got a word for the way that we're doing it. Coy on a Scotsy, crazy world. Hope you got a word for the way that we're doing it. Coy on a Scotsy, crazy world. Hope you got a word for the way that we're dying.
Okay, this is Judy, and I'm back, and I believe I have on the phone with me Karen Pickett. Karen, you there?
Yeah, I am. Hi.
Hi. Well, we just saw in the news last week a couple of articles, and the first one, actually, it was the same article, it's from Associated Press, but it was talking about this slap suit and what they called it. I don't know if they called it this in your paper, Karen, but it said, Equipment owner wins vandalism trial. Grangeville, Idaho, the owner of road building equipment that was wrecked in the Nez Perce National Forest, has won more than $1 million in damages from 12 Earth First activists he accused of vandalism. The verdict is much more favorable than we could have ever imagined when this began, said his brother and attorney, Ron Blewett. We proved that the defendants aren't noble defenders of the earth. They do the environment more harm than good, and they certainly aren't noble. Our victory is in establishing that the Earth Firsters are merely modern-day gangsters and thugs, and in sending a warning volley to others who would join them in similar conduct. So, having heard that very slimy description, because it says, if you read this carefully, it doesn't ever say that Earth First is sued for vandalism. It says a guy who accused Earth First of vandalism has won a suit. So why don't you tell us what the suit was actually about?
Well, I actually hadn't seen that coverage, and I have a story here that's from the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, which fortunately is a lot better. That's a pretty gross misrepresentation, because it was not a vandalism trial at all. And in fact, you would think that in order to get the verdict that they got, they would have had to connect some of the defendants directly with some of the activities that they were claiming damages from.
One would
and
think.
They were not able to make even an indirect connection. What they were trying to show was that the defendants were part of what they put out as an international conspiracy, and therefore liable for any damage that they say occurred in the Cove Mallard area in central Idaho in the summer of 1993. It's obviously a harassment lawsuit, and actually just before the trial started, the attorney for the other side, and there's Don and Ron Blewett, and they're really the twin clowns. Don Blewett is owner of Highland Enterprises, the road building company, and Ron Blewett is the attorney for Don. And Ron Blewett said that while in the beginning they thought that this group of people had some resources that they could recover, they've seen that that's probably not the case, especially since Ramon filed bankruptcy, and that this case was no longer about money. What it was about was preventing these people from coming back to Idaho.
Well, okay, Ramon.
It's so outrageous, because legally, you can't do that.
Well, I guess in Idaho you can't. I want to back up for a minute, because I don't think everybody knows who Ramon is. Actually, people who have been around here may have seen him. I think he first showed up in Redwood Summer driving this great big bus that he called the Ancient Forest Bus Brigade.
Uh-huh.
And he got involved up in Idaho, and he got so connected to the trees and the struggle up there that he actually used his life savings to buy a 20-acre parcel to use as base camp. So that's why they thought that he was rich or something, or they thought that they could grab his money.
Right, but he, you know, he lives on a pension, and he uses that pension to support a whole bunch of other activist activity as well, and activists themselves. And this, I mean, this lawsuit right from the get-go was pretty ridiculous, because they had a whole laundry list of activities, some of which did happen, like civil disobedience actions, which, you know, did slow them down. And some activities that may or may not have happened, you know, they alleged this damage to equipment, but they never connected anybody to it, and it wasn't clear just what happened and how much damage there was. And then there's activity that clearly did not happen, that they probably made up or was a setup. They mentioned a tree spiking, which there's no evidence that it actually happened, and certainly nobody was ever connected with it. And even if something like that did happen, it wouldn't have affected the economic state of this road building company anyway, because it wasn't where they were building their road. So it's this very broad laundry list of activities, just saying, oh, these bad people are doing all these things. And then the list of people was also a very broad list, because it included people who were doing civil disobedience for the first time, organizers of the campaign, longtime Earth Firsters, fundraisers for the campaign, people who were supporting the campaign from other states, like myself, and there's people just from all over the map. And they're trying to say that all of these people are involved in this huge conspiracy, and, you know, the point is to do damage to Highland Enterprises, when in fact the target was the Forest Service. It wasn't a private corporation at all. Highland Enterprises happened to contract with the Forest Service to build this road in a wilderness area. You know, that was their bad luck and bad judgment, but the target was the Forest Service. And Highland Enterprises was trying to say that the liability for anything that happened there should be extended to everyone, including, and this is a quote, including anyone who gave a hitchhiker a ride into the vicinity of the timber sales.
Well, talk about a broad net.
Yeah. Well, that's why, you know, we're hoping that an appeal could be successful, because we knew from the get-go that this was a setup for failure. The judge had expressed his contempt for Earth Firsters in general and Earth First as an organization in open court. And there really wasn't much of a chance that we could get a very fair jury. And, in fact, one of the lawyers said right after jury selection that he had the feeling that some people probably lied about their potential biases and about, you know, how they made their living or something. Because something like 85% of the people interviewed had some kind of connection to the timber industry. And he felt that probably some people lied in order to get on the jury so that they could string up these Earth Firsters.
Wow. And, of course, this isn't a very friendly place. I think one of the things that I really see is the difference in a community-based movement here and in there, where you're defending some vast tracts of federal land in an area that's basically hostile. And one of the things that had happened before this slap suit was just an amazing law that was passed, the Earth First Law, that was passed in Idaho to try to stop the protests. Will you describe that?
Yeah, it made it a felony to basically to encourage people to come to Idaho, to in any way encourage activity that would get in the way of timber operations.
So it made speech a felony.
Pardon me?
It made speech a felony.
Right.
And
right.
Now, Robert Hoyt wrote a great song about it. I looked all over the place, and I couldn't find a copy of it.
Yeah, it's a great song, and one of the best things about the song is it's a real easy sing-along, because it's a kind of a catchy tune, and you can commit a felony by singing the song with Robert.
All right. Well, anyway, if I find it eventually, I'll play it on another show for you all, because I couldn't find it today. But now, with the settlement of this suit, it's over $1 million. Is there an injunction or anything too, or is it just the money?
It's just the money. It's $1,150,000, and most of that is punitive damages, which is all the more reason to appeal it, because that is such a bad precedent for them to have these huge punitive damages against nonviolent protesters. And it's not clear yet what they're going to be able to do to use this to harass people. They have said, you know, the people involved in the lawsuit, for the most part, don't have much for assets. There are a few property owners in there, and supposedly homesteads are protected. But things like savings accounts, even small savings accounts, are not protected. And they've made it clear that they do intend to use this to harass people and, you know, have a chilling effect on other people that might be thinking about going to Idaho to defend Cove Mallard, because it's still a very active ongoing campaign, and also to prevent these particular people from coming back. I mean, it's not working, but at the same time, they will be able to use it to harass people. And you can sell these judgments even when it happens in another state. There's these outfits that I guess are like collection agencies, and you can sell a judgment to them, and then they go after the people in their own state. And one of the things that that Don Blewett, the owner of Highland, said, that he does expect to be able to extract something from these people over time, because the award, unless it's thrown out in the appeals court, would remain in effect for the defendants' lifetimes. And what he said is, if their great aunt Matilda buys a Volkswagen van and she dies and gives it to one of them, that baby's mine.
Oh, whoa. So, have they done anything to let you know? Have they tried to, like, freeze your assets or anything like that?
Well, they haven't yet. I mean, my assets, such as they are.
Right.
But I was actually thinking of sending a direct action fund check for $1 million to them.
Oh, that'd be great.
Go ahead. Cash it, suckers.
So that actually, and for people, a lot of people may be familiar with the Direct Action Fund but not realize that that's what we're talking about here. Karen is sued in the slap suit in Idaho as an administrator of the Direct Action Fund, which kind of helps support Earth First Actions all over the country, not just Actions in Idaho. Is that the only capacity? Were you actually up there, or were you just sued for the fund?
Well, I'm named as an individual, and the Direct Action Fund was named as well. So, you know, we're both
filing
a lawsuit. And, I mean, the Direct Action Fund, when there isn't money in the bank account, it doesn't really exist because it's not incorporated. So that's what they would do, is go after me as an individual. But obviously part of their aim was to shut down the Direct Action Fund. And I think that they don't realize, you know, how many incarnations something like the Direct Action Fund could reemerge in. And, you know, it's not going to, it's an annoyance. It'll get in the way a little bit, but it's not going to slow down the Cove Mallard campaign. I don't see it slowing down any other Earth First campaigns, and it's not going to stop us finding a way to support monetarily the Earth First Direct Actions around the country. We just have to adjust and figure out other ways to do it. But, you know, we're a pretty creative bunch.
Yeah, there's always Friends of Earth First.
Right.
So, you know, I know that they have these high hopes that they can make us go away, and they really haven't. I don't know. People, of course, know that LP sued us around here, and Bruce Anderson will tell you a million times that we rolled over and sold out, even though when he was sitting in jail over that letter, eventually he said, well, I might as well just turn it over because there's no legal recourse to be had. And that's pretty much what we figured out in the LP slap suit, is that if we went through it, there was no way. I mean, it's not a First Amendment right to block a log truck, even though it ought to be. You know, and there's no way we weren't going to be convicted if we went through the whole court thing, and that not only would we end up with an injunction, but we'd end up with a judgment. Mm-hmm. And certainly a judgment and an injunction is more of a impediment than an injunction. And we found in Albion that the injunction has not been any tremendous impediment. You know, they've had injunctions against us before. And another thing people may not know is that Pacific Lumber has sued us many times. They sued you too, didn't they, Karen?
Yes, they did, a few years ago.
So, you know, the idea of timber companies suing us for these activities are really not new. And although they're hoping that people will cringe and be afraid, also in Oregon, I know Kelpie, some other people got a judgment against them for just a very awesome action, almost all women's action, in which somebody climbed to the very top of a yarder and let down this banner that said, "From Heritage to Sawdust, Earth First." And they were sued for that and got a judgment against them. And they appealed, and they lost the appeal. But still, it hasn't ruined their life.
Right.
Because we're not rich, being most of us at any rate. And there is, I know Kelpie told me that she's allowed to make, I don't know, what, $25,000 a year or something like that?
It's, yeah, the limits are different in each state in so far as what you can own in property for your homestead and how much you can make before they attach your wages. And it's true that they haven't been able to collect against protesters. It was the slap suit down here where you see the University of California sued People's Park activists as well, and they ended up winning that suit on legal grounds, but the judgment was thrown out so that they couldn't collect money. So that was essentially a victory. But it's, you know, this case was filed 3 years ago, so it has taken time and energy from people who would be doing more productive things with their time during that time. And so it's something that we need to fight for that reason, because it's a trend, and we need to make it expensive and an unpleasant experience, and ultimately an unsuccessful experience for these corporations.
And we did a great job of that up here.
That's really the best reason for us to appeal. Unfortunately, it's going to take like $10,000 to file an appeal, but we have a really good legal team who wants to appeal, so there's a pretty good chance we will.
All right, well, I hope it works. I know, I don't want to compare us to the anti-abortion movement, but I did read an article in the New York Times about the fact that they were slap-suiting the anti-abortion movement, hoping to crush it, and discovering that it didn't work because people weren't rich, and because the treasuries, rather than, that treasuries were kind of ad hoc treasuries for specific things, and so they couldn't destroy the organization by attaching a particular treasury. And I do think that, you know, that to that much we do have in common is that we're not rich, and we're not a centralized organization. So I'm not, you know... Maxam, they made some vague threat about suing everybody who crossed the line. Well, come on, sue all 1,033 of us. I want to see you do that. And the other thing about getting a slap suit is, of course, you get discovery against them. And I'd love to get a little more discovery against Maxam. That's how we found out about those papers where they admitted that they were distributing fake press releases in our name. Mm-hmm. We got that from discovery from a slap suit. So anybody who's up in headwaters, I guess what I want to say is, I don't think I'd worried about this one little bit. I'm just like not even worried about it. The chances that Maxam could do it, the chances that they could get away with it, the chances that they could get a jury to convict us here with all this public support are really slim. And even if they do convict you, here's Karen talking to us, you know, and she's not like all freaking out. So I want to let
right.
people know that. So.
Well, I think that they, you know, they have earned the reputation at this point so much as the villain corporation. This campaign has such widespread popular support that I think in that context, you know, it's a really different context than Highland Enterprises suing us in Central Idaho. I don't think that Maxam could do that right now in California. We kind of have this shield around us. I mean, not to be naive about it, but you know that that widespread public support is a real important preventative measure.
Yeah, I think so too. Okay, well, so are you going to be selling your house?
I don't own my house. I'll have to talk to my landlord about that.
Really? Or maybe your old car. I don't know if anybody would even buy that.
I have several old cars, actually, that don't run. But, yeah, I really would like to send them a million-dollar check. And I think, you know, I think that we can use this. And I do know that it's already been a more unpleasant experience for them than us. We've really had some fun with this, and it's been a much more expensive experience for them than us.
And that's exactly what happened with LP.
Yeah.
I mean, we had some hell of fights and all that stuff, but all in all, you know, we drove them crazy, and they were happy to settle that suit.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, well, thanks a lot, Karen, for keeping us up on that one and correcting the weird news media.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, okay. Well, onward and upward.
Okay, I'll be talking to you.
Okay.
All right. Bye. Thank you. Okay, that was Karen Pickett, longtime Earth First organizer, actually probably the longest time Earth First organizer of everybody that I know that's still in it. We have another call here. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Judy. This is Linda Perkins.
Oh, Linda. How perfect.
Am I,
you are exact. I was about to ask you to call.
Oh, good. Okay. Okay, here so, I am.
All right. Well, I'll tell people why I asked you to call.
Okay.
You know, we've been focusing on Headwaters on this show so much for the past several months that I don't know about you all, but I've been kind of losing track of what's been going on in my own county. And, you know, they just had this salmon ruling that, interestingly, they ruled the salmon endangered right up to the corporate line. They stopped it just south of Headwaters so that it won't affect the Headwaters habitat conservation plan and all that stuff. But on the other hand, pretty incredible that they actually admitted that it was endangered in Mendocino County. So I wanted to go over with Linda, who diligently monitors the timber harvest plans for Mendocino County, is what's happening out there, and, you know, is this going to affect us?
Well, I have some very good news. While you were focusing on Headwaters, LP and GP came to all the environmentalists and said, we've discovered the errors of our ways, and we're going to institute state-of-the-art forestry starting today.
Oh, that's so cool.
Isn't that cool? And I guess I'm supposed to add not to that.
Well, I don't know. It's state-of-the-art.
That's the revolution here in Mendocino County.
Oh, darn. You turn around and you blink, and, you know, you never know what happens.
Right. No, of course, the coho listing is the news of the hour, and I find it amusing, depressing, angering, depending on my mood, because nobody knows what it means. It might have the listing might have sprung full blown on all of us like a rabbit out of a hat. To judge by the reactions of the agencies, who of course have done no preparation in terms of putting regulations in place, so nobody at this point, everything is shaking down and falling out, but nothing definitive is shaking down or falling out, so people don't know what's going
so
to happen.
They're not like changing their plans or anything like that. They're just going right ahead with their timber harvest plans.
That's right. I inquired yesterday during second review of timber harvest plans at CDF. I attend that every week. I inquired as they finished a plan and recommended it for approval if they thought the mitigations on that plan were sufficient to protect the coho, because a timber harvest plan has a life of 5 years, up to 5 years. So anything that they approve today before the coho ruling actually goes into effect, or that has been approved, has a life up to 5 years, and of course they'll be operating on them with no protection for the cohos.
Wait a minute, you're saying if they already got the timber harvest plan approved, they don't have to change it because of the coho?
That's right, as far as we know.
That's disgusting.
They do not. At any rate, I asked that question, and I was met with blank stares as though people hadn't remembered the coho at CDF.
Surprise.
And including water quality. Just looked at like, well. And I think, of course, what the bottom line is going to be is a number of lawsuits, because there will be a lot of plans that are active when the ruling goes into effect that we could challenge on the basis of a take of the coho.
Do you think this would help, for example, and I know people were talking in the case of Russell Brook, which is like the last clump of old growth left in the county, practically, and, you know, for people who may, I think everybody pretty much remembers, we did a good job of getting that one out, that this was LP land that they lied and said that it was second growth, and through the work of Linda and others, they were exposed for lying, and they got their timber harvest plan withdrawn when they found out it was indeed old growth, and this is on like a tributary to Big River. And the thing about it is it's kind of surrounded by clear cuts. So it seemed the perfect place to file a lawsuit on cumulative impact. Do you think, is that, of course, they haven't resubmitted the plan. What's going on with the
timber? No, they haven't resubmitted it. What they have submitted about a week ago, there's a new plan coming through, which is on Big River, just north of Big River, where Russell Brook comes into Big River. Russell Brook comes in from the south into Big River, and just on the north side of Big River, LP has filed a 40-acre clear cut. That's the total of the plan, 40 acres of clear cutting. And my feeling about it is that what LP is doing is testing the waters.
See how close they can get or how much they can liquidate
right.
around it?
Right. And can we piecemeal it? Can we take this, clear cut this 40 acres, and then perhaps move into Russell Brook a bit? We have been told that they are going to file a plan before the end of the year in Russell Brook, and it would be ideal to challenge, of course, on the basis of the coho, not to mention the late successional forest. So, at any rate, where we are right now and what we know is that they have filed this 40-acre clear cut, and we're going to be taking a close look at that. This 40 acres presumably does not contain late successional forest as it's defined by the rules, but they do mention in the timber harvest plan that there are scattered residuals. And we'll be looking. We'll have to go ground truth it to find out what is actually there.
Okay, so... What's happening actually on the ground, though? I haven't been seeing as much coming out of Mendo as I used to, despite Mike Janella's article about how everything is rosy because the price of timber has raised so much that
right.
even though they're cutting less, they're making more money.
Well, because of the fire in Lake County, the Forks Fire, as it's called, which was, of course, extensive, and a lot of damage was done by the fire itself and by the fire roads and the fire breaks that had to be cut in to fight that fire. And everybody, not everybody, but most everybody, is over there hauling logs out of that area.
And you can see those logs coming into Will.
Over there to try to get things in shape before the winter, so that there won't be massive amounts of erosion, which is what it looks like at this point.
And part of that burn was on LP land, and of course there's the rumor, whether it's true or not, that they let it burn. And I know that LP moved in right away to start salvaging because a logger friend of mine who's working on that job told me that they did. And then I also read recently that they got a salvage permit on the rest of the cut. And I mean, I don't know. I've seen these trees going by on the road, and they don't look... I don't know whether they're actually dead or not. I mean, they're only burned a little bit. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't. I haven't actually seen any of the trees. And I know that there is an inspector assigned to the area who has been inspecting the operations, even though they're emergency exemptions. They're being inspected. And the only other thing I've heard is when I have been at CDF, various and sundry foresters came in right after the Forks Fire and were whining and saying, well, am I going to have to flag the water courses, the streams? Am I going to have to keep bulldozers out of the streams? In other words, am I going to have to follow the forest practice rules? This is an emergency. And they were assured that, yes, they'd have to follow the rules, even though it was an emergency. So all I know is that the RPF whined, and then they moved in.
Boy, I wonder if there's going to be anything left, though. Just somehow the Warner Creek issue up north in Oregon, that was a burn. That was an issue where
right.
a forest had burned, and they succeeded in making them leave it alone so it could come back naturally.
Right.
And I have to say I'm not knowledgeable about whether this bark beetles and all that other stuff is really true or whether it's just more excuses to cut more wood, because it seems like whatever solution that they have to anything, the answer is always cut more trees.
Cut more trees, yes. And it's hard to know because our forests are so damaged. Some things that might not be true in a natural forest might now be true.
Right.
I really don't know.
The other thing I heard from my logger friend, who doesn't want his name said on the air, is that the LP, well, now we know they're supposed to be moving their executive offices out. I don't know if they have yet. Maybe if somebody's out there in Calpella listening, they could call us and straighten us out here. But anyway, what I've heard is that they've only got one mill running right now. They've only got one shift at Fort Bragg. They're stacking logs up to the sky in Ukiah. You can see them every time you go by. They're stacking them up to the sky in Willits. But that those mills are not actually running, and that LP is actually selling logs to other companies like Eel River rather than milling their own stuff in this little mop-up operation as they get out of here. Do you have any information on that?
Well, again, it's rumors. We've heard from various loggers that, yes, the Ukiah mill is not operating. They're stacking logs. You drive by, you see the trees are trying to grow again. They're actually sprouting. They have to water them so that they don't crack and check and deform and so forth. They keep them wet, and the redwoods have started sprouting again. They're piling up, and what we heard is that they can't get the equipment to operate. It's such a state-of-the-art mill that they can't get it up and running.
Oh, well, if that's what state-of-the-art is, then maybe that wouldn't be so bad.
I like it. At any rate, as far as the COHO listing is concerned, we just don't know at this time what impact it will have on logging. I have heard that NMFS, at least at one point, that's National Marine Fisheries Service, who listed the COHO as threatened, recommended 800-foot no-cut zones around Class 1 streams. Those are fish-bearing streams. Around Class 2 streams, they recommended 400 feet of no cutting. Class 2 streams are ones that have other aquatic life, like amphibians and aquatic insects and so on, but no fish. And then Class 3 streams, which are ephemeral streams that run just during the winter, there's also a big no-cut zone. And if that were actually enacted, which of course it will not be, that would mean about 50% of the land would be in this area with our topography would be no cut. And of course the timber companies would sue for a take of private property if such a rule were instituted.
And of course this government would never stand up to them.
No, and the current forest practice rules don't have any no cut zones next to streams. They have protective zones, which means that you have to limit your cutting, but you can cut right up to a stream bank as the rules read now.
That's really disgusting. I guess that explains why the county looks the way that it does.
Right. Nothing really has changed. The bureaucracies are the bureaucracies. They're in denial. They're trudging along, doing what they see to be their job, which is just following whatever rules someone hands them. And same old situation. There have been some meetings. I want to mention this on the air, if I may. In Mendocino, Big River Watershed meetings, community meetings. There will be one next Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock at the Rec Center in Mendocino. And there have been very interesting discussions at these meetings. We've had both industry there and neighbors and community members and so forth. And there have been some lively exchanges at these meetings.
All right, well, let's hope there's some lively logging blockades as a result of them.
Right.
And then one more thing I just want to make, I already know the answer to this, but I want to make sure people who are listening to this report know there hasn't been any activity in Enchanted Meadow, right?
No. As a matter of fact, I think that Louisiana, I don't know this to be a fact, but I think that Louisiana Pacific pulled out their LTOs, as they call them, the workers, the loggers, to take them over to the Forks Fire area to work. The Albion, at least the lower Albion, seems to be shut down. There are no operations going on right now.
All right. Well, let's keep it that way.
One other thing, Judy, has it been reported on the air what the outcome of the Tidewater protests and Louisiana Pacific's charges against protesters?
Oh, no. Actually, I don't think it has. I know that happened a couple weeks ago. Why don't you update us?
Yeah. There were two types of charges filed. Some people got criminal charges filed.
Wait a minute. Hold on. I don't think Tidewater's protest has been identified.
It's a protest of a timber harvest plan in Albion in January, February of this year.
There you go.
And Louisiana Pacific charged, the DA charged people with criminal trespass and criminal contempt of court. There were, I think, about six people charged with that. And LP ordered another seven people to appear in civil court to show cause why they shouldn't be held in contempt of violating the settlement agreement, which was not to interfere with logging in a physical way in the Albion Tract. That was our settlement. So there were two legal actions going on. What happened with the criminal charges was that LP or the DA ended up dropping. I can't seem to draw the distinction between the DA and LP. Excuse me.
Gee, I don't know why.
they seem to be one and the same. Dropped the charges against several of the people. One of whom was Naomi, and then the other people pled no contest and were ordered to do 20 hours of community service at the organization of their choosing.
Wow.
And I think Bill Heil asked for time served on the Tidewater protest, but the judge, no, that doesn't count.
too bad. That's community service for
then,
sure.
And then after that happened, after the criminal charges were settled, LP dropped the civil contempt charges.
Oh, that's great. So for all the people who are, like, you know, trembling in fear over this, here you go. Once again, it's just a paper tiger. And I don't think we really have to be too afraid of these kind of things.
Right. I think some of the confusion from the original flap suit carried over. And even though there were a total of perhaps 8 people or 9, 10 people charged, LP was still so confused that they couldn't proceed.
Right.
He had put people on who had not even been on the original flap suit, and et cetera, et cetera. So once again, it was a muddle, even though it was fewer people.
All right, but that's good news to hear that it just got disposed of. So
That's behind people. So.
All right, great.
Okay.
Okay,
so
thanks for the report.
The update, and thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, that was Linda Perkins reporting from Albion on the state of Mendocino County logging. Dismal as usual, but I guess they're all out there raping the forks fire. The time is 1.5 minutes after 1 p.m. You're listening to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo and KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah. Also K202BE Fort Bragg at 88.3 FM Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. This is the Punch and Judy Show, and this is your host, Judy Barry. Well, for the rest of the show, I had actually planned on having Dennis Cunningham on because he was in court today on the Covelo civil suit. If you remember with the murder of Leonard Peters and the events with Bear Lincoln, the arrest of Bear Lincoln, along with that, there was just a really incredible reign of terror that was just throughout the Covelo area and in Round Valley against the local residents while they were looking for Bear and basically taking anybody that they wanted to, holding guns to children's head, cursing at grandmothers, various other stuff, and intimidating a whole community. And there's been a civil rights suit filed about that, and Dennis is the lawyer. And he was supposed to call me, but you know what? Well, first of all, he hasn't called, which, you know, he's sometimes tends to be a little bit spacey. But the suit was this morning, and he told me he was absolutely sure they'd be out by noon. But it's quite possible that they aren't. And what's happening, it's in the federal court, and as usual, the county, this is a suit against the county of Mendocino, the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office, and, you know, represented by the county of Mendocino, they're making a motion today to dismiss the suit without a trial. And so Dennis was supposed to come on and tell us the results of that, but either he spaced out or he hasn't gotten out yet. So we'll give you a report on that next week, and I'll just go on to what I was going to do next. And that is, I've been for just weeks and weeks and weeks putting off reporting on my own FBI lawsuit because there's always something more pressing. And I think it's about time for me to stop putting it off and start talking about it and get you all up to date on it because we have a big hearing coming up on November 22nd. So that's what I want to do for the rest of the show. But I'm going to give you one last window to call in, 895-2448, on any subject or any kind of announcement that you want before I get started. Including, I heard on the Environment Show there's some protests being planned about Caltrans and spraying. Somebody wants to give us an announcement on that. It'd be great to hear it. And here's a phone call. Oops. Caller, you're, there we go. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Judy?
Yeah.
Antoinette.
Hi, Antoinette.
Say, listen, what do you think the settle-out is on the Coho? Do you think that this latest ruling will do any good or not?
You know, it's really hard to say. My experience, I think a lot of our experience, unfortunately, is that it doesn't seem to matter what rules they pass. They still manage to interpret these rules to mean cut more trees.
Yeah, and of course, the more trees you cut, the worse off the coho are.
That's for sure.
And there's no way of separating trees and coho.
That's, and you watch the topsoil going out in plumes into the ocean when it rains.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of people that don't realize that the trees are not separate from the coho, and we have to keep reminding them.
Well, I hope that we can do it, including in lawsuits and in demonstrations. I agree with you. I think it's something we really got to move on and try to make it mean something.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye, Judy.
Bye-bye. Okay, we got another caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Judy. This is Alan Levine. And
oh, hi, Alan.
I have some stuff to add on the coho. I'm sitting here right now while I'm listening to the show, typing up a 60-day notice when this listing becomes effective. The Board of Forestry is being told that their management scenario for our timberlands will be out of compliance with the Endangered Species Act and therefore legally indefensible.
So
but
is it,
there's a lot of contingencies, and I think there's room here for the state to actually work towards developing some rules. If the governor has his way, it won't happen, but it is a manageable situation. And if they did come up with prescriptive protective rules for water course protection, I'm sure we'd see a lot of benefits without taking 90 or 50 or 60 or 40 or a significantly large percentage of timberlands out of production. I think that taking less than probably 8% of the lands out of production would, in the near stream zone, would provide significant protections, as well as monitoring road construction better and employment of erosion control devices and other things that have to be managed appropriately relative to the administration of these plans.
I think I missed this. Is the thing that you're typing, is it for just the lands overall, timberlands in general, or is it for a particular timber harvest plan?
It's for, no, timberlands in general. In terms of the coho listing, I believe it becomes effective the 25th of January. They put in the Federal Register, and it takes 60 days to be effective statute, or whatever it's called. And need to develop an answer to the problem in that short a period of time. And if they don't have an answer to the problem, then they're operating outside the law and can be challenged.
Well, I sure hope so.
Either in state or federal court. You know, the listing for threatened extends from Malibu to the Mattole River,
right?
And that section of the state, really, the populations are so low that they should have been declared endangered. But the protections for endangered and threatened are not that significantly different. And the decision was a political one, something that might be easier for the private landowners, because we're talking mostly about private land in that section, to swallow. Now, the section that you were concerned about, from the Mattole River to the Oregon border, or actually to the state of Washington, NIMS is saying that there's such significant controversy, which there really is not controversy. Almost all the science points towards severely depleted stocks on the verge of distinction.
I understand that the statistics is something like it's less than 2% are left, and of those 2% that are left, 10% of them are in the headwaters forest water system, the streams that go in there.
Yeah, I would revise that estimate of saying that there's probably between 2 and 8%, but that's still significantly, endangered or threatened populations. And the timber industry has put in some last-minute argumentative declarations about that they found some other populations. And they have, but those populations aren't really significant. They're really very minor, and the biologists doing the work admit that it should not change the status as a threatened or endangered a stock of fish between that. There's a big problem with the ESU's evolutionary significant units. In reality, almost, every smaller grouping of streams have slightly different strains of fish, and the strains are not suitable for survival in other watersheds. They've been developed through to fit the needs of specific watershed survival problems that are endemic to a particular type of conditions. And the ESU that they picked is so large that it's messing up the whole assessment of specific populations, like the Walla River. All the rivers up to Mattole have hardly any fish at all.
Yeah, well, it's amazing how they can use science to justify, keeping on going when there's nothing left. You know what, Alan, we got another call on, and I want to be able to fit this stuff in, so
I'll end by saying that usually science can work to solve the problem, but when you start getting the politicians and the vested interests with big money in there, then things start going wacky, and it makes it more difficult to solve the problem.
That's for sure. Okay, well, thanks for your work. I hope we can come up with something to stop them on this.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we got another caller. Caller on the air.
Hi, Judy. It's Beth Bosk.
Hi, Beth.
I tried to catch you right after Karen Pickett, but I got a couple calls myself. I want everybody to know that I have one of my Long People magazine Dostoevsky interviews with Kelby Wilson in the next issue of New Settler, where she talks about the Sapphire Six and the ramifications of that. Zia Catalini and I are going to trial on the original Louisiana Pacific slap suit case January 27th. This is 4 years later, going on 5 years later, maybe?
Uh-huh.
Like, something like that.
Yeah, no, it's really long.
And the defense that we are using is one that really fits everyone, and that was that Louisiana Pacific sued this community with unclean hands, having to do with its understanding, its knowledge of an occupied osprey nest, which was in a protection zone. That's number one. Maybe we can talk about that some other time. Out of this lengthy suit have come two things. Joel Pennock and I were able to establish the right of people who have equity in their homes and homeowners insurance to go to those carriers and demand that they be provided with a defense because it's part of our contract. And that was a big victory because you don't want forest land fights without people who live around those forest lands participating in them. They tend to be stabilizing folks. That was one thing that has occurred. The other thing that has occurred in the settlement talks back and forth between myself and Louisiana Pacific, none of which have ended in anything concrete. I'm always trying to trade my cross-complaint for some kind of policy change. But out of that has come a diminution of personal suspicion, and three of the LP gentlemen are going to be on my radio show tonight, and we're going to be talking about their version of vegetation management and how that can be further altered, changed by people in this community. So I hope people will listen in and call in. That's on KMFB, which inland folk will catch at 96.7 and coast folk at 92.6.
Okay, and the time?
From 8 to 10.
Okay, great. I'm really glad you have a radio show, Beth.
Thank you, Judy.
Even if I can't get it at my house.
Right.
All right.
Right, bye.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, so actually I didn't even know. I knew that was kind of coming up sometime, but I didn't realize it was so soon. That should be very interesting to follow. Okay, I'm going to stop taking phone calls now so that I can actually get through this. And I'm going to try. I'm not going to be able to do a tremendously detailed report here because, as usual, we're running out of time. But what's happening in the bombing court case right now is we have a major hearing coming up on November 22nd. And we didn't expect to be having a major hearing on November 22nd. We thought we were going to have a minor hearing on November 22nd. And we thought that the larger hearing that would be coming up wouldn't be until next spring. But the FBI surprised us, and they pulled this little move where they separated out. It's the same thing as in Covelo. It's a motion to dismiss. Now, we've already won 3 motions to dismiss in this case. It's been in court for 5.5 years, and we've won them 3 times on motion to dismiss. But because of the way that the laws are written and changes that were made in the laws under Reagan, they get to come back one more time now and argue that this case should be dismissed without a trial. And in order for them to win this motion, what they have to say is, we have to agree it's called, they have something called qualified immunity. And what qualified immunity means is that you can't sue the police if they accidentally shoot the wrong person or, you know, something like that. They accidentally bust into your house and they meant the neighbors. Anything that was a mistake that they make in the course of their duty, they are immune from suit on. So in order to be able to sue the FBI, you have to show that they did whatever they did in a deliberate and malicious manner, that it wasn't done caused by a mistake. So that's what they have to prove to win qualified immunity. It's not enough for us to prove that Daryl and I were falsely arrested. We have to prove that it was knowingly, consciously, and deliberately, and not because of an honest mistake in analyzing the evidence. So that's a pretty high standard for us to meet. However, the idea of dismissing a suit without a trial is something that the court doesn't do too easily. And in order to get a suit dismissed without a trial, what you have to be able to prove is that all of us, both sides, agree on the basic facts of the case, that the important facts of the case are not disputed, and that even if those facts or what took place, then no violation has occurred. And when they file a motion like this, asking to dismiss it without a trial, the evidence has to be taken in our best light, in the best light of the people who are making the charge. Because if there's any question about it, the question is supposed to be settled by a jury trial. So if we win this motion, then we supposedly would now go on to a jury trial, as we've been trying to do for the past 6 years. But it's kind of hard for me to see how they could possibly win. But they pulled a really sleazy one on us, surprise, surprise. And what they did was they filed, we were expecting this to be this huge motion. We have our lawsuit against the FBI charges them with a bunch of civil rights violations. We charge them with false arrest, illegal search and seizure, denial of equal protection of the law, and with a conspiracy to violate our First Amendment rights by discrediting us as terrorists in order to neutralize us so that our speech would not be heard. So those are the basic charges. Those four charges are the basic charges in the case. And really, you kind of have to make the same argument to answer each of those because they're very related, just like salmon and trees. You can't separate the false arrest from the illegal search. But that indeed is what the FBI has done. They filed a motion to dismiss just the illegal search. And they said, now you have to realize that there's a lower standard of proof for searching somebody's house than there is for arresting them. So what they're trying to do is get the court to dismiss the search warrant and say that the search was legal, the searches of my and Daryl's houses were legal, and that it should be dismissed without a trial. And in order for us to win this, what we have to show is that the search warrant was based on lies. And we certainly can do that. But, you know, I think I have enough time to do the prelude to this, so I'm going to back up a little bit and hope I can get this all in by the time the end of the hour. Before this happened, the reason this has all been taking so long and being delayed, first it was supposed to be last spring, and then it got put off, and it got put off. And there's a couple reasons why it's been delayed, and a lot of them have to do, these motions are motions that are supposed to be held after both sides have had discovery, after we've seen all their files, after we've gotten to question all of their witnesses under oath, and they've gotten to question ours. Very interesting, for the last 5 years, the FBI has had the right to question me under oath, and they've never done so. Do you think they really think I bomb myself? Anyway, So one of the reasons that everything's been delayed so much is, first of all, because the FBI is very intransigent on not giving up stuff in discovery. Like, for example, we got all these documents with all these things crossed out, and we'd say, there's no excuse for crossing this out. We'd go back to the judge, and we'd say, okay, judge, this needs to be uncrossed out. And the judge would rule in our favor, and they'd still not cross it out. Or the other thing is on witnesses. There's a lot of very strange things that happen with these files, hundreds of pages missing, all kinds of weird things, and they've agreed to come up with certain witnesses. In fact, the court ordered them to come up with the witnesses to explain the discrepancies in the file. And what they're just amazing. They're so brazen. They wait until the day. In fact, actually yesterday we were supposed to have a deposition of a witness to talk about all the omissions in the file, all the missing pages and stuff, and they just called us up and said, sorry, we're not doing it. And then we have to go back to the court and get another order. So, and they never get punished for this, by the way. They never get sanctions or anything like that. Just eventually they give us up half of what they were supposed to, and then we're supposed to be happy with it. So for the last 6 months, since we were supposed to be having this motion to dismiss hearing, but we didn't have it, they've been stalling on discovery. But there's been another thing going on, too, and that is that they concocted the most incredible web of lies that you've ever seen in order to throw confusion on the case and in order to justify their absolutely groundless arrest to try to come up with some excuse for it. And what they did was they invented a fake informant tip. They claimed that when they arrested me and Daryl on May 24th, 1990, after the bombing, that one of the reasons that they thought that this was our bomb was because they had a tip from a reliable informant that the heavy hitters from up north were going to be traveling to two heavy hitter Earth Firsters from up north were going to be traveling to Santa Cruz for some action involving a bomb. That's what the FBI says. Now, the problem with this is that, first of all, it's not true. There was no bomb plot, but there was no tip. There was no tip of the kind. And we said, well, if you had a tip like that, we said, now this isn't reflected in the warrant or anything. They never wrote this down. They just said, well, we knew about it, but we didn't want to blow the informant's identity, so we didn't tell anybody. But the real reason why we arrested them is partly because we had this tip. So we said, well, if you had this tip, Then we need to see some evidence that this tip existed. Was it in the files anyplace? Did it show anyace? And, oh, yes, yes, and they claim. And there's no evidence of them either receiving the tip or ever following up on it. If they had such a tip, you would think that they would have gone right to Santa Cruz and come up with the informant and said, hey, here's these people got caught with a bomb. Are these the heavy hitters you were talking about? Can you go back and get more, et cetera, et cetera? But not only is there no evidence that we've seen in the file of the informant tip existing, but secondly, there's no evidence that they ever followed up on it, so we don't believe it for a minute. What they did do, however, is after I was bombed, I was bombed in May, and by July, they kind of knew they were in trouble. They really didn't have any grounds for arrest, and this was right before the Alameda County District Attorney decided that they wouldn't press charges. So what happened was on July 20th, the FBI put out this memo, and it says, San Francisco has developed a source that indicated prior to the Oakland bombing that heavy hitters from up north, possibly associated with the organization called Earth First, were coming to Santa Cruz, California to be involved in some type of an action involving a bomb. Now, this is what I called future past tense. San Francisco has developed a source that indicated prior to the bombing. So we said, why do you wait till July to come up with this, and what is it based on? So after much wrangling, I mean, this has taken years. We've been arguing this for 2 years. We've been arguing about this informant. And what they finally came up with, they gave us two pages, and they said these pages constitute the informant tip. And they're all crossed out, as usual, right? And one of them, the only thing it says is, this also took us a long time to get this all crossed out. But what it says is this is from May 18th, 1990, from before the bombing. It says it has this informant, and the informant, we even know who she is. She's not a reliable informant. She's somebody from Santa Cruz who was snitching off her friends. We know for sure that it's hers because the Santa Cruz cops testified that it was, that she was the informant. And she was just this kind of crazy person. She wasn't anybody with any reliable information. Anyway, she says to the FBI, last week, a few heavy hitter activists came to Santa Cruz from Canada and the Western United States. They stayed for a few days, then left to return at the end of May for a major action. Now, notice it doesn't say heavy hitter activists. This is the only reference to this tip that comes before the bombing. It doesn't say anything about a bomb. It says a major action. It doesn't say anything about Earth First. It says a few heavy hitter activists came to Santa Cruz from Canada and the Western United States, not from up north. And so each time they described this tip, it got more elaborate, and it got more and more supposedly describing us. Now, the other one that they gave us this all-crossed-out document that all you could see was Rico, who is one of the activists from Santa Cruz, told the source that that someone from out of town was going to come to Santa Cruz soon with a bomb that would be used against a power facility. But they crossed out the date on that memo. So we finally, after much wrangling, got the date uncrossed out, and it turned out that the date was June 12th, after the bombing. So they submitted this as evidence that they had this tip before the bombing. Well, of course, they didn't have the tip either before or after the bombing, because it didn't exist. And we hunted down Ted Rico. We found out who he was. We got this great declaration from him about how he never said any such thing. And what we demanded is, we said, if you're claiming you have this tip, and you know you've lied about it, you've lied about having it before the bombing, you've lied about what it constitutes, then we need to find out who this informant is so that we can depose them and find out what the truth is. And at one point, the judge ruled that we could do this. You may remember this one in the AVA. Bruce Anderson said that we won a ruling that they had to tell us all their North Coast snitches, but you can be sure Judy Barry will never do that. Well, of course, that was no such ruling. The judge ruled that they had to tell us that snitch's name. But the FBI balked and wouldn't tell us their name and filed another motion and got it withheld so they didn't have to tell the name. So, finally, we've just been wrangling back and forth and back and forth over this, and each time they've talked about it, it's gotten more ominous. By the last brief that the FBI lawyer wrote, it had gone from heavy hitters from Canada and the United States coming for an action to Earth First to two heavy hitters to a bomb. And then the very last brief that Joe Scher, the FBI lawyer, wrote, he actually wrote in it that the reason we can't give up the name of the informant is because this information about this alleged bomb plot was so tightly held among plaintiff circles, that's my and Daryl's circles, that just revealing the who the informant was will reveal the whole thing and expose undercover agents. And so now he's gone from saying that there was a tip about a bomb plot to saying that there actually was a bomb plot. So he just kept going farther and farther out on the limb, and it was getting pretty out of hand. Well, finally, we had a hearing on that, and we had the hearing on it about a month ago, and what happened in the hearing was actually pretty good. Even though the judge is a wimp, she'll never completely rule against the FBI. She's given us some pretty good rulings. What she finally said about the informant, whether they had to let us depose the informant, whether this tip was anything that they could base their claim of a legal arrest on, she said, the FBI cannot use the informant privilege. That means the right to not reveal informants. The FBI cannot use the informant privilege as both a sword and a shield. It says, if the FBI wants to assert that there was an informant tip that is not reflected in the written record, then they have to produce the informant to be questioned. But on the other hand, she said, but if you just kind of shut up about this, if you don't mention the informant tip anymore, then we'll just drop the whole thing. And so the FBI was willing to do that, and that was pretty amazing. After 2 years of fighting them over this fake tip, they were willing to just say, okay, we won't argue this informant anymore. So they're no longer claiming that there was an informant and that there was a tip. But Dennis answered, my lawyer, said, that's not good enough. It's not good enough to just say, okay, we'll shut up about it. Fact is that they lied about it. And the fact that they lied about it shows the conspiracy, it shows their bad faith and the bad faith of the arrest itself. But that's where it was left. The FBI decided to just drop it. So now that they've filed this new thing saying that they're going to say that the search warrant was perfectly legal, they listed the reasons for the search warrant and they just didn't mention the informant at all. So lacking the informant, that means they have no grounds to speak of, because the search warrant, this is a warrantless arrest, so they have to go on the search warrant. The warrant has three big lies in it. The first lie is it says Special Agent Frank Doyle says that the bomb device was on the floorboard behind the driver's seat when it detonated. And he also says that he told your affiant that a separate bag of nails was discovered in the vehicle that are identical to the nails taped to the explosive device. So lie number one is the location of the bomb behind the seat where we could see it. Lie number two is that they found nails in the car in a bag that matched nails in the bomb. And lie number three is that Barry and Cherney are members of a violent terrorist group involved in the manufacture and placing of explosive devices. And when we asked them what explosive devices, Earth First has never been involved with a bomb ever, except as a victim in our case, and they said the explosive device was the one in my car. But anyway, so they were really sleazy in this brief. It was pretty stunning. And what they argue is they say, well, we all agree on the facts. They say Frank Doyle said that the bomb was under and behind the seat and that the nails were similar and things like that. So Dennis really creamed him in his answer. He says the FBI is not arguing about what's in the warrant. They're just using their excuses that they made up after the fact. That it's not, they didn't say in the warrant that the bomb was under and behind and possibly visible. They said it was on the backseat floorboard. They didn't say nails were similar. They said nails were identical. So this is what we have to go in and argue now. And now, in order to meet this motion, we have to present our essential proof that what we've learned through the depositions. And it's pretty juicy and it's pretty, it's pretty clear. I just can't imagine. If we lose this case, I don't have much faith in the system. But I'd lose all, if anybody could possibly rule in the FBI's favor on this one, it would be stunning. Because those of you who have seen the photos, it's quite clear, as Dennis says in his wonderful brief, Stevie Wonder or Ray Charles could have seen that bomb was under the car seat and not in the back seat. And the FBI's own bomb expert from Washington, D.C. eventually testified that it was hidden and that, all that stuff was right. So anyway, we have this hearing on November 22nd, and it's in Oakland at Claudia Wilkins Courthouse. And we're going to have a demonstration at 12 noon out in front of that courthouse, and it's on Clay Street in Oakland, and we'll be having carpools going down. And the thing about a lawsuit like this, we've been really laboring by ourselves for years and years, and there's not much way that the public really even can show support for a lawsuit like this. So this is one of the few opportunities for people to be able to demonstrate public support against the FBI for still engaging in these outrageous kind of tactics that they never stopped. I mean, the case of Richard Jewell is pretty mild compared to this case. At least he wasn't bombed and arrested. He was just accused falsely. But anyway, they're still doing it. They've never stopped. And if we want to show some support for this case, which I believe is out there from the calls and stuff I get. So if people would like to come and join in that, then you can call the MEC at 468-1660, find out about carpools. But mark that date. I'll talk about it a little more when I have a little more time on another show. But at any rate, it's going to be November 22nd. 12 noon is the demo. The hearing actually starts at 10 a.m., so you could come down for both of them if you wanted to. Anyway, we're out of time again, and that's it for the Punch and Judy Show. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.